From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Washington Watch. Coming up on this Thursday edition, Israeli elections once again failed to produce a winning party. And there is, once again, a deadlock with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's Likud party having won 31 seats to the Blue and White party's 33 seats as of the latest count. What does this mean for our key ally in the Middle East? Chris Mitchell, CBN's Middle East Bureau Chief, joins us from Jerusalem in just a moment. Finally commenting on the ghoulish discovery of over 2,000 bodies of aborted babies in the home of abortionist Ulrich Klofer. Mayor Pete Buttigieg said this.
I find that news out of Illinois extremely disturbing.
Out of Illinois, what about what happened in Klofer's abortion clinic in South Bend, Indiana, where Buttigieg serves as mayor? Indiana Congressman Jim Banks joins us with more. And I'll talk with Andrew Pollack, whose 18-year-old daughter, Meadow, was killed on February 14, 2018, in a Parkland, Florida school, along with 16 others. He has co-authored a book entitled Why Meadow Died, The People and Policies That Created the Parkland Shooter and Endangered America's Students. His passion is to see how we can prevent future tragedies at public schools and spare other parents the grief which he endures every day. And in our final segment, I'll talk with Sarah Perry, FRC Action's Director of Partnerships, and my guest host here on Washington Watch, who will connect the dots between the lenient educational disciplinary policies advocated by the now discredited Southern Poverty Law Center, President Obama, and the deadly shooting in Parkland, Florida. All of that and more coming up on this Thursday edition of Washington Watch. The website, TonyPerkins.com. Let me remind you, just around the corner, the Values Voter Summit, October the 11th through the 13th here in Washington, D.C. But here's the good news. There's still room for you. Go to the website, TonyPerkins.com. Sign up now to be a part of the premier gathering of social conservatives, as you will hear from congressional leaders, you'll hear from conservative thought leaders, and you'll be able just to hang out with conservatives like yourself from around the country. Again, find out more. Go to TonyPerkins.com. All right, for the second time in less than 6 months, Israelis went to the voting booths, and in a national election, they got the same results. It appears to be essentially a deadlock. Joining me now to discuss this from Israel is Chris Mitchell. He is CBN's Middle East Bureau Chief. Chris, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Hey, Tony. Great to be with you.
I know they're still counting the ballots, some that are coming in from those outside of Israel, counting some of the military ballots. Where do we stand as of right now?
Well, I don't think those ballots are going to change the final results much. I think they're about 97% of the votes counted. Looks like Blue and White has 33 mandates or seats in the Knesset. Likud has 31. But the more important number from the Likud point of view and Benjamin Netanyahu is that there are 55 seats on the right side of the ledger, and they've already signed a commitment that they will stand behind Netanyahu to form a possible government. On the other hand, Benny Gantz, the head of the Blue and White Party, he thinks that he has the mandate, as it were, to be the next prime minister and have a coalition government. But the big news right now, Tony, I guess the next step will begin on Sunday, and that's when President Reuven Rivlin will sit down with each and every party that has seats in the prospective next Knesset. And he's going to ask them, who do you want to lead or be the one to form the next coalition government? It very likely could be Benny Gantz in the Blue and White, or it could be Benjamin Netanyahu with the Likud. And then that person or party will have 28 days to form a new government, 14 more days if they need more time, and that will determine possibly either a coalition government that will go forward and lead Israel, or it's a possibility it could go to a third election.
Now, Chris, let me step back for just a moment and explain to our listeners kind of the parliamentarian system there in Israel, where you put together these coalition governments and you have to have the majority of the seats, which I think is 61, in order to be able to, you know, put that ruling coalition together and claim the prime minister spot.
It's exactly right. It's a matter of math, Tony. 120 seats, and you need in the Knesset, you need 61 to have a coalition government. So what happens after an election is the number one party typically is the one chosen by the president to go ahead and meet with other parties of like political mind and try to get to that 61 seats and form a coalition government. And that's the way they do it here. The reason they're having second elections now is because even though Benjamin Netanyahu and his Likud party had more seats than the blue and white last time, he was unable to form enough parties to get to that 61 seats.
So he has 55 behind him now, so he's six seats short of putting together the majority. Were you surprised by the outcome of this election?
Not really. I think a lot of people said the polling had said it was going to be pretty much the same result. And I think it was it was actually even closer than people had said. And it looks like either party right now, blue and white or Netanyahu's Likud party, really doesn't have a clear way forward. So there's a lot of jockeying going on right now between the various parties. Earlier today, Benjamin Netanyahu had made an appeal to the blue and white party, and Benny Gantz said, form a coalition government with me. Benny Gantz, a few hours later, rejected that. And a lot of things are going on in the news. And there's a lot of personalities on here, too, Tony. Avigdor Lieberman, he's really a key player in this as well. He's a bit of a kingmaker because he has nine seats or mandates in the next particular Knesset, and he really could swing those votes one way or the other, and he wants to see a unity government that he would be part of, but we'll see what happens starting on Sunday. But lots of politicking going on. Some people say, you know, it's, you know, if you look at the U.S. political system, it's sort of like ice cream. It's chocolate and vanilla. But over here you have chocolate, vanilla, strawberry, coffee, chocolate chip, and now we seem to have Rocky Road as well.
And it's all swirled together.
Exactly.
When you get the coalition government, it's pretty fascinating to watch. But there's some key issues here. And as I and so from my vantage point, as I've, you know, watched it, and you, you're the expert, you're there in Jerusalem, but it appears that there are a couple of things at play here that are driving the two different or the factions there. One is I saw the speech early this morning from the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, talking about, you know, they would put together a pro-Zionist government. They would not allow those that want to fracture or to in any way harm Israel's sovereignty. And you actually have some of those in the parliament that won seats. So that's an issue. But then you have also the ultra-Orthodox. That's an issue where the issue of them serving in the military and not being required to, that's an issue with the other side. So there's some really dynamic issues here that are going on, and I want you to comment on that. But also, in this time of flux, is Israel more vulnerable? Because, you know, we saw this, what happened in Saudi Arabia. You were actually in Saudi Arabia when those attacks took place on the oil fields there. Is there a sense of maybe instability right now?
Well, there may be a sense of people looking in from the outside that there is instability or being vulnerable at this time. I don't think so. I think the IDF, the military, is, you know, using 24/7 surveillance and intelligence to guard against any particular threats. And one thing you could say about both Likud and Blue and White is that they pretty much are on the same page in terms of the threats that Iran, that Israel faces, particularly and most importantly, Iran, Hezbollah, Hamas. So they're all pretty much on the same page there. But to your point, you made you addressed probably the two main points right now. The first of all is about the joint list. And what this is a coalition or a combination of about three or four Arab parties. And they have never served in an Israeli government. And part of the reason for that is that many of these Arab parliamentarians actually would rather have the Jewish state eliminated. And so it's very difficult for any coalition, and right now they have 12 seats or mandates, to bring them into a coalition government. And so that's part of the challenge that Benny Gantz has right now, because he may need those kind of seats to get his majority. And it's very unlikely that they would join him or that he would want them to join them. The other thing you mentioned is this secular religious divide. It really is fracturing Israeli society, and actually was one of the factors that we've gone to the second election, because Avigdor Lieberman in the last election was unwilling to join a coalition government with the ultra-Orthodox. The ultra-Orthodox, they don't want to serve in the military, and there was a particular bill requiring them to have a military service. Lieberman said, we've got to pass that bill. They said, no way. And so really that makes it so much more difficult and complicated for some of these coalition partners to join with one another. So you have these two issues, the Arab parties, and you have this religious secular divide that are really driving some of the machinations going on politically right now.
So what's your sense? Do you think that Benjamin Netanyahu, who has, I mean, the longest serving prime minister there, he's, I mean, had a grip on the leadership reins for quite some time. Will he be able to survive this and pull together a coalition government?
It's possible. If anybody can, it's probably Benjamin Netanyahu, who is sort of a master politician, but he has very daunting challenges. The first one, obviously, is whether or not he'll be chosen to try to form a coalition government. The second thing he has, Tony, is that he has some legal challenges. October 2nd and 3rd, there's going to be hearings with the attorney general here, Mandelblit, who's going to determine whether or not to indict the prime minister for breach of trust or bribery. And which way that goes is really going to determine some of his legal and or political fate. So it's very challenging. And as he said today for his appeal for a unity government, even if he does become prime minister, he might have to share power with another prime minister. It happened before in Israeli history where you had, you know, two sides having a unity government, but they would alternate prime ministers for 2 years and then 2 years. So it's possible that Bibi Netanyahu may not be the kind of prime minister he has with exclusive power, you know, over a coalition government as we go forward.
Very interesting, fascinating, and something we'll keep a very, very close eye on. And I do appreciate you staying up late, Chris, and joining us from Jerusalem to give us the latest on the Israeli elections.
Thanks, Tony. Glad to be with you.
All right. Have a great night. Chris Mitchell, who is the bureau chief, Middle East bureau chief for CBN News. I would encourage you to be praying for Israel. A lot unfolding. In fact, we're going to be talking about in the coming week the plan. It's called, I guess, a peace plan that the Trump administration is going to be revealing. Been talking with folks about that. A little concerned about it, but we'll be following that. But coming up next here on Washington Watch on this Thursday edition, Mayor Pete Buttigieg weighing in finally on the atrocities from the abortionist from South Bend, Indiana. We'll talk about that coming up next with Congressman Jim Banks.
In states like New York, Virginia, and Vermont, radical legislation has been written legalizing abortion late in pregnancy, when babies can feel pain and are able to live outside the womb.
Happy birthday to you.
They've gone even further, repealing protections of infants born alive, allowing killing even after birth.
Happy
Congress has yet to protect the life of every newborn baby. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com to send Nancy Pelosi a newborn hat to show Congress every new life should be welcomed with warmth and love, not hate, not death. End birthday abortions. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com.
Happy birthday to you.
Paid for by Family Research Council.
Are you concerned with the state of our nation? Do you want to protect and promote religious freedom, the sanctity of life, free speech, and our children's educations? Today we see a growing threat against our values on the news, on our college campuses, in our elementary schools, at our public libraries, and in our courts. Every year in Washington, D.C., thousands of conservatives attend FRC Action's Values Voters Summit. From October 11th to the 13th, come to our nation's capital to mingle with and hear from key conservatives who are bringing real change to Washington, D.C., and learn how you can too. FRC President Tony Perkins will be there, along with Ali Stuckey, Bill Bennett, Dana Lash, Oliver North, and U.S. House and Senate leaders. The 2020 elections are right around the corner, so this is one weekend you won't want to miss. We provide free scholarships for students. Register online at valuesvotersummit.org or call 1-877-372-2808. That's 1-877-372-2808.
Are you looking for timely and honest coverage of the latest news? Do you find it difficult to sort out what is true and what is false from the media? Family Research Council is here to help. FRC President Tony Perkins' daily Washington Update email newsletter addresses the most important current events affecting religious freedom, the protection of life, marriage and family, and more, not only in Washington, but around the world. The Washington Update's daily articles cover a range of topics, from underreported stories about transgender activists' efforts to infiltrate our schools to updates on court cases fighting for religious freedom, parental rights, and the protection of life. Don't miss this critical, in-depth analysis of the day's most essential stories that are shaping our nation's future. Learn more and subscribe by visiting frc.org/update. Again, that's frc.org/update.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins. All right, there are new calls for an investigation into abortionist Ulrich Clofer's South Bend, Indiana abortion mill after more than 2,000 babies, the bodies of aborted babies, were discovered at his Illinois home. Now, Clofer died earlier this month, and the family found the remains just a couple of days ago while cleaning out his home. Now, he had multiple abortion mills in Indiana, running one in Fort Wayne, another in Gary, and one in South Bend. Now, South Bend happens to be the home of Mayor Pete Buttigieg, and he was been silent about this. Well, finally, he was kind of cornered and asked about this, and here's a clip of what he had to say. Greg, play the longer clip from Mayor Pete.
Like everyone, I find that news out of Illinois extremely disturbing, and I think it's important that that be fully investigated. I also hope that it doesn't get caught up in politics at a time when women need access to health care. But there's no question that what happened is disturbing. It's unacceptable.
What happened in Illinois? What about what happened in South Bend? Well, joining me now to talk about this, Congressman Jim Banks, who represents the 3rd District of Indiana, serves on the Armed Services Committee, the Education and Labor Committee, and Veterans Affairs Committee. Congressman Banks, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Hey, Tony, good to be with you.
You've been out speaking about this. You've been in the press, making very clear there's a South Bend, Indiana connection here. Not only is the clinic here, but Mayor Pete went to bat for some of those clinics there in his home city that were operating in such a way that endangered the lives of women.
That's right, Tony. There's several layers to this story. It's almost there's nothing funny about this story, but it's hilarious to hear Mayor Pete's response about not making this political. It very much is political because Pete Buttigieg in 2018 as mayor of South Bend vetoed a zoning ordinance that would have allowed a pro-life women's care center to set up shop next to Whole Women's Health, which is the abortion facility that got set up after Dr. Clofer was put out of business. Some of his staff set up a new abortion clinic called Whole Women's Health. And Mayor Pete, while he talked about not making this political and denying women health care options, Mayor Pete himself vetoed an ordinance that would have allowed a healthcare option for women, a pro-life healthcare option for women, to be set up right next to the legacy abortion clinic of Dr. Klopfer. So it's interesting to hear his response. So far, he has yet to clarify why he vetoed that measure, but it was on the eve of him becoming a presidential candidate. So we can assume that actually, in fact, it is all about politics.
Right. Absolutely. I don't want to go down that trail. There's so much I can say about that, the duplicity, the hypocrisy there. Every time there's a shooting, they politicize that to call for gun control. But then when we see these this string of atrocities that are connected to abortion clinics, Kermit Gosnell in Philadelphia, we have in Houston, and now here in Indiana. But you folks may not know this. Before coming to Congress, you were in the state legislature there, and you worked with then Governor Mike Pence to restrict some of the activity or to provide better health care and oversight for these abortion clinics. And so you have some firsthand knowledge about this particular abortionist and the shady operation that he ran.
Well, this is the interesting part of this story, Tony. Mayor Pete likes to compare himself and juxtapose himself with Mike Pence. I mean, he really hit the rise of his political candidacy for president coincided with attacks that he made on the character and faith of a man that you and I both know is maybe one of the most decent people that we've ever met in American politics, and Mike Pence. When I was a state senator, I worked with Governor Pence and at the time and other pro-life legislators to pass statewide admitting privileges legislation that was directly related to the practices of Dr. Klopfer. Because Dr. Klopfer had an abortion clinic in the city of Fort Wayne in my district. Around 2011, county commissioners passed at the local level an admitting privilege ordinance that required abortion doctors and directly targeted Dr. Klopfer to have admitting privileges with a local hospital. And we later passed that as statewide legislation because the practices of Dr. Klopfer were well known. There were several complaints about his practices. At one point, he did have admitting privileges and a doctor that backed him up in Fort Wayne, but because of a botched abortion, that doctor ceased to back Dr. Klopfer. But this is where this gets really curious, because way back in 2011 to 2014 or so, we knew how bad of an actor Dr. Klopfer was, but yet Pete Buttigieg still defended his legacy and those who worked for him all the way up to 2018 in allowing the same type of practices to occur in his hometown of South Bend. One doctor in South Bend, in fact, Tony, said that this whole women's health clinic that was set up after Dr. Klopfer was put out of business. They listed Dr. Klopfer's assistant on the paperwork when they set it up, and it was even one doctor even said that they used the same type of practices that Dr. Klopfer used, which was this and referred to them being sort of 1980s era abortion practices. We can speculate that that would be saline abortions, which is the type of abortion that leads to the highest number of botched abortions and babies born alive after a failed abortion. So at the very least, Mayor Pete owes the American people as a presidential candidate an explanation for why he would allow that clinic to continue to operate in South Bend and veto alternatives, pro-life alternative options for women to set up in his hometown as well.
Congressman Banks, we're just about out of time, but very quickly, the discovery of over 2,200 bodies of aborted babies in his house, does that surprise you, given what you know about how he operated?
It's a sickening and sad story. No way around it. But we know he was sick and demented, and that's why we need a federal investigation into this, Tony. I know President Trump has agreed with us. Because the babies were found in Illinois and the abortions were performed in Indiana, we need a federal investigation. I hope that will happen soon.
All right. Congressman Banks, thanks so much for joining us. Good to talk to you. All right, folks, don't go away. When we come back, the shooting at Parkland High School in Parkland, Florida. We're going to talk with one of the fathers of one of the girls killed there. An amazing story that gives you a behind the scenes of what really happened. That's next. Don't go away.
Do you know that Planned Parenthood was using taxpayer dollars to perform abortions? Recently, the Trump administration made changes to a healthcare policy called Title 10. The changes to this policy now eliminate the loopholes organizations like Planned Parenthood were using to receive taxpayer funding for abortions. Planned Parenthood was hiding behind terms like reproductive health care and services like cancer screenings and contraception distribution, while in reality, they were making money off of abortions. This shift in funding will benefit community health centers that provide needy families with family planning resources and health services, regardless of their ability to pay. It will also benefit pregnancy resource centers that provide care and free resources to women who may be experiencing an unplanned pregnancy. This policy decision is the right move to help and protect American lives. To learn more, visit frc.org/Title 10. That's frc.org/Title 10.
Hi, my name is Bailey. I am serving as an intern at Family Research Council, and it has been a life-changing experience. Interns join FRC's team of experts as they embark upon the mission of advancing faith, family, and freedom in public policy and the culture from a biblical worldview. The FRC internship is a 12 to 15 week program designed to educate and inspire university students who are passionate about public service and who believe that a biblical worldview is fundamental to the reformation of government and culture. As interns, we receive the opportunity to work alongside and be personally and professionally developed by FRC's team of experts. This paid internship offers free housing in the heart of DC, which allows us to be fully immersed in the fast-paced political climate and to build a community with other faithful conservatives in our nation's capital. For more information and to apply, visit frc.org/internships. That's frc.org/internships.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins. On Tuesday here at the Family Research Council, we featured our latest edition of our speaker series. We have speakers that come in, authors and others. And this was a particularly stirring lecture, a discussion, speech, session. I don't know what really what to call it. But Max Eden and Andrew Pollack are co-authors of the book Why Meadow Died, The People and Policies That Created the Parkland Shooter and Endangered America Students. And I'm a little tongue-tied here because this is a really such a powerful message. And it's actually on the website, TonyPerkins.com. You can go watch the entire conversation that took place here at FRC. But I wanted to invite Andrew Pollack to come on the program today. Now, he happens to be the father of Meadow Pollack, who on February 14, 2018, a senior at a high school in Parkland, Florida, was shot along with 16 other students. It was done by Nicholas Cruz, a 19-year-old expelled student who had a semi-automatic rifle and went in and killed 17 students. Now, Andrew was, as I said, here on Tuesday. He shared the tragic story of the murder of his 18-year-old daughter, Meadow. And here's just a portion of what he had to say here on Tuesday.
My son told me there was a shooting at the school. You know, I didn't think anything of it. I just thought, you know, it was just maybe it was one incident or something happened with a police officer. It was an accidental misfire. But as the day started regressing, it started getting worse, and the calls kept coming in, and then we couldn't find Meadow all day long. So we went from hospital to, my wife worked at the hospital, so we had to look. I had her going from room to room in the hospitals looking for my daughter. We couldn't find her that day. She wasn't in the operating room. We gave up our search. It must have been about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and that's when we regrouped at home. And I knew personally when we couldn't reach her by 6 o'clock that my daughter was murdered.
Mr. Pollack, I cannot begin to imagine the depth of your pain as you continue to mourn the death of your daughter. But I want to thank you for sharing this story, boldly sharing this story, so that others might be spared what you have gone through. And thank you for being here at FRC, and thank you for joining me here on Washington Watch today.
Oh, thanks for having me on and, you know, giving me the time to tell my story and to warn parents about what's going on in districts across the country. And, you know, people ask, you know, a lot of people, you know, I never really touch on this. They always, you know, people that are short-sighted, they'll say, well, it was the killer. You know what I mean? He's the only one I should be blaming. Okay? But when you look into it, I really blame that the killer for about 50%. And then the other people that all failed my daughter in that system. So, you know, because there's multitudes of failures that happen. And the love that I have for my daughter is I'm going to expose them all. And that's what puts me on this quest with this book to get it out and to warn parents and to hold these people accountable one by one for letting this happen to my daughter in that school.
Andrew, what was the first step? I mean, how did you know that this was a much bigger problem than just a shooter going into a school and shooting students? I mean, what was the first clue that showed you that this was just the tip of the iceberg of something that had been created by the policies of that administration?
The first one, it didn't resonate that it was the school district. The first one was the tip that went to the FBI. The woman had called me that called the FBI and said that he was going to be a shooter, that he was going to shoot the school up. And the FBI failed miserably. She had called them, a couple of people called them. And then she started telling me about the shooter. I don't mention by name. She started telling me about the killer, that she warned them, that she even called the sheriff's department and told them that this kid was just a bad, evil kid from the beginning. And he was going to shoot the school up. So that happened pretty quickly within the first week of, you know, my daughter getting murdered. While everyone, you know, was still, you know, the day after the shooting, the superintendent was calling for gun control. Robert Runcie, who brought those policies to Broward County. So from that, then I started getting calls from students. You know, before the shooting was over, students knew who the killer was. Okay, the school monitors, they call them. You know, that's what they have in liberal schools. They call them monitors. They give them a radio, and they're pretty much useless. You know, the monitors had a meeting about the killer a year prior, saying if anyone was going to shoot the school up, it was going to be this kid.
Andrew, we're up against a break. I'm going to ask you to hold on because I want to finish this on the other side of the break, because you shared some facts Tuesday here when you spoke at FRC that, quite frankly, were absolutely shocking. And people need to know this because this is not out there. This was not told. You're telling the story. It needs to be told. Folks, you need to stick around. You need to hear the rest of what Andrew has to say on the other side of this break. We're coming back with more Washington Watch as we talk with Andrew Pollack, author of a new book, Why Meadow Died. It's about the Parkland shooting and the policies behind it. That's coming up next as we continue our conversation. Don't go away.
We live in a time of great political division, and this division only intensifies during campaign season. The toxic tone in politics can be discouraging, which makes it a very real temptation for many Christians to wipe their hands of politics altogether. After all, if God is sovereign and controls the heart of the king, as Proverbs says, do we really need to get involved in the messy world of politics? Because political engagement can be divisive, shouldn't Christians abandon politics and direct their energies toward more spiritual pursuits? Christians are called to submit every area of their life to God, which includes how they engage in politics. But they are called to engage biblically. This requires Christians to be prepared to follow their political theology to its logical end and vote for candidates and parties that support clear biblical values. For more information on the Christian's call to engage in politics, visit frc.org/engage. That's frc.org/engage.
Radical abortion laws in New York, Illinois, and Vermont are challenging the sanctity of life. These laws have lifted the few existing restrictions on abortion in the name of family planning and mental health of pregnant mothers. Americans need to take a stand and defend the rights of the unborn. Family Research Council is sending Congress 90,000 baby hats as a reminder that babies should be welcomed with love and warmth, not potential danger. Supporters have already funded over 45,000 hats. We are over halfway there. Join Americans across the nation and donate $9 to send a powerful reminder that young lives need to be cherished. When you take action, we'll send you an end birthday abortion certificate that will remind you to pray for born alive babies who are facing the danger of being killed outside the womb. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com for more information. That's endbirthdayabortion.com.
Hello, this is Tony Perkins, President of the Family Research Council here in Washington, D.C., and I would like to invite you to join my wife, Luana, and I, along with Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin and former Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann, for FRC's Israel Tour, June the 2nd through the 12th, 2020. Whether you're sailing on the Sea of Galilee, standing in the ruins of Capernaum, or journeying up to Jerusalem, Israel is unlike any other place on earth. You'll relive the final earthly days of Jesus as you pray in the Garden of Gethsemane. You look upon Golgotha and stand in the garden tomb. The reality of his story will come alive in a transformative way. This one-of-a-kind tour will not only allow you to explore the land of the Bible and the roots of our Christian faith, you'll also hear firsthand from some of Israel's political, defense, and religious leaders. Join us June the 2nd through June the 12th for this life-changing experience. For more information, visit TonyPerkins.com or call 844-872-5155. This is Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins. The website, TonyPerkins.com. In fact, you can hear, watch the entire message that Andrew Pollack presented here at the Family Research Council in our speaker series earlier this week. Go to TonyPerkins.com. It's posted right there. Andrew, thank you for sticking around through that break. You were talking about that there were warnings. You know, they talked to the FBI. But you shared a fact, a number, that literally almost caused people to fall out of their seats here. The number of times that the sheriff's office went to Nicholas's house. How many times?
Yeah, 45 times. And the reason why this happens with these policies in place is that the sheriff is an elected official, and he signed on to these policies with the superintendent to reduce crime. Okay, so what they do is they manipulate the statistics to make them like they're doing the greatest, he's the greatest sheriff in the country by reducing crime by 30%. He could say that when he runs for sheriff again in his next term. But what they do is they just stop arresting. Okay. And that's why when a lot of these Democrat leaders push for background checks, then they push for, but then they push these policies of not arresting them.
You mentioned Democrats and your dog started barking. Have you taught your dog something?
Yeah, well, he's trained. Yeah, okay. Exactly. Right. People always ask me, why is your dog, what does your dog do? Is it a service dog? Well, they hire me to go into companies and he sniffs out Democrats. That's what my dog, that's what my dog could do. But on a serious note, you know, these policies were brought, they started with the Obama administration to decrease the school to prison pipeline, decrease suspensions and expulsions.
Let me ask you this question. Not to correct the problems, just to quit reporting them.
Correct. And because the teachers were racist. That's really where it comes from. The teachers didn't have the ability, they didn't trust them to suspend or expel kids equally. Okay? That's where really it starts. And what happens is it creates a whole policy of leniency within the district where teachers just stop having any type of discipline. And these programs that it started in Broward are throughout the whole country. And that's what parents see. I'm the last father that could say I didn't know these things were going on in school. I didn't know that this kid was so dangerous they had to frisk him. Could you believe that? They frisked this kid every day before school. That's how dangerous he was. They didn't let him in with a backpack. But they don't tell the parents or warn us. You know, they never told me. The teacher has notes. He would say he wants to kill. Did they tell the parents? No. Did they tell the parents they had to walk him around with a security guard from school, from class to class? He was infatuated with shooting, with guns. He would draw stick figures and shoot people, like, with his gun all day long. He'd jump out behind, like, corners of the school in like, a cackle and scare kids. And this is – the teacher had to write these notes for, like, 6 months. She was hostage. So she had to be really particular in her note-taking to just get rid of this kid out of the school. All right? So that was middle school. He goes to a special school, right, where he's supervised. One summer, they're so worried about this kid, how he's acting, they write a note to his psychiatrist that he's dreaming of blood. He talks about killing. There's a hatchet. There was a hatchet missing from his garage, right? And they were so worried that they wrote to their psychiatrist about changing his medication. But those same counselors that were overseeing him, like 8 months later, recommending mainstreaming him with my daughter into the high school because of these programs. And what program, what class did they put him in high school? They put him in JROTC, where they teach him, and they give him one of those air assault rifles. That's what they do. That's what they all the kids in Douglas. They subjected them to a type of kid like this. And if parents think it was just in Broward, it's not the case. These emotionally disturbed kids are throughout the whole country. And in order to recognize what you're looking for, you got to see what happened in Parkland and read my manual and see what they did to my daughter, why Meadow died. Read the book, and it's jaw-dropping, but everything is factual that we took from it. And mainstream media, they didn't want me anywhere in New York or D.C. I didn't get on any mainstream media that's liberal. The only parents that were actually in the country that know the truth about what happened in Parkland had to watch Fox News, because Fox News had me on all week telling the truth of the story of Parkland.
This doesn't fit the left's narrative.
No. It doesn't. It's, you know, they wanted to blame the gun. And I'm not a political guy. If it was the gun, I'd be talking to you. Yeah, it was the gun. But after doing my research and these policies in place, it wasn't the gun. It wasn't the NRA. It's these policies that allowed him to be in that school, that allowed for him never to be arrested. He trespassed at the school after he already threatened to shoot the school up at the sheriff's department.
Still, but they didn't arrest him.
Didn't arrest him. So what good is a background check if they don't want to arrest criminals that are dangerous? I'm not saying we don't want all kids. We don't want to hurt kids. Kids that just make a mistake. Sure, right. Let's put them into certain programs that they're mentored by, you know, law enforcement or people. Let's mentor those kids. But some kids that are mentally disturbed, threatening people's lives, punching their mother's teeth out, you know, skinning chickens, they need to be introduced to the judicial system to protect society. Okay, but with these policies, they don't do that.
Amazing. And a point that you made is that this policy coming down from the Obama administration with the school district and with the sheriff's office there was kind of a pilot, but this has been adopted in other school districts across the country, right?
Thousands of schools, Tony. And look, California, people want to question me. Okay, you want to doubt me, my research. look what happened right now in California, okay, if you're a parent. They just passed a law. It's illegal to suspend disruptive kids in the state of California. So could you imagine being a parent, even if you are a Democrat and have a problem taking in facts, why would you want to subject your kid to an environment where the kids could be disruptive as they want, okay, do it without any consequence? It doesn't make sense to me. And now those policies, okay, that I uncovered in Parkland that got my daughter killed, now is a law in California. And it's throughout the country, and it's their platform.
And parents don't know about it.
They don't know about it. But look, anybody, Google, if they Google Gavin Newsom, this new law in California, and it's parents don't even know about it. I didn't know. You know, look at the mistake I did, you know, putting my daughter in the school with this animal. And they never told me. Yeah, I'm going to – who would put their kid in a school where you know someone's so dangerous they're frisking the kid? Could you imagine that? And they don't tell the parents? And this is going on. This is why Meadow Died, the book, is so important, to get it out there, read it, okay? Look at all the facts I put in there of what happened with these policies, of all the interviews with the teachers, the notes, the disciplinary records. And then when you're done with it, go give it to one of the teachers at the school or give it to a school board member and make sure, because it's what I say to everybody now, parents, you're responsible where you put your child. It's not the politician. It's not the president. It's not your governor. It's not your superintendent. It's you. You decide. Am I going to put my kid in that school? Do I want him going to a charter school, private school, home school? You're the decision maker. Don't do what I did and just think that my kid was safe there. Okay? And odds are, Tony, that your kid's not going to get shot like my misfortune. But why put them in an environment where they could sell drugs, where they could get beat up, where they could get bullied, where there's no consequence for a student to speak back to the teacher? And the teacher's got to spend, on average, 10, 12 minutes per lesson dealing with disruptive kids. It's not the right environment, and parents need to speak up. They're the only ones that can make a difference with the public school system.
Well, Andrew, I want to thank you for speaking up. I want to thank you again for your book. Thank you for coming to FRC and lecturing and joining me here today. And we're going to encourage folks to get that book. We're going to promote it and encourage them to share that information with others. So, again, our condolences to you, but our gratitude as well for speaking out. So thanks so much for joining us today, Andrew.
Thank you, Tony. Thanks so much. Have a nice day.
All right. Andrew Pollack. To find out how you get a copy of the book, go to TonyPerkins.com. But also watch that lecture and share it with others. Powerful. And I didn't know. I honestly did not know the depth of the – I don't want to say what was going on there was criminal. And this started with the Obama administration. But there's even more to that. And joining me now to unpack this, to connect all the dots, my Friday host here on Washington Watch, Sarah Parris. Sarah, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thanks, Tony. Thanks for having me. It's fun to sit in this chair for a while.
Yeah, welcome to the Thursday edition of Washington Watch. there's more to these policies because there's an organization that was actually behind the Obama administration pushing this down to Broward County?
Well, it's an organization that you and I know a fairly great deal about. That's the Southern Poverty Law Center. And as Andy mentioned yesterday in the lecture and again on the show today, this would be a very easy answer to go ahead and blame the gun lobby. That's a very facile response to a problem that continues to come up. And that would be the easiest solution if we didn't know what we know now. And after extensive investigation, we've learned that this started back in 2007 with a prison reform project, a school to prison reform project back in 2007, launched by the Southern Poverty Law Center. This organization partnered with the ACLU and the NAACP to prove that there was racially disparate impact in disciplinary procedures, that minority students were disciplined more often and in more severe ways than white students or neurotypical students. And of course, that is the case in some arenas, but that is also subject to other factors not discussed by the SPLC as concerns this particular school district. They continued to push this narrative. The narrative gained steam. They testified in front of Congress in 2012. They called for this reform in 2013. They provided a report to the Department of Education under Obama's Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan, the same one who created the Common Core concepts, delivered this report, whole cloth, the school-to-prison pipeline, proving that schools were systematically racist and teachers could not be trusted to enforce their own disciplinary policies, and that there was no reason to arrest these kids or suspend them. And in doing that, they created an environment of danger because the direct consequence was Obama's Department of Education issuing a Dear Colleague letter in early 2014, right after the first of the year. And immediately afterwards, the SPLC came out praising the Department of Education for adopting those policies. And the rest, as we know now, is history. The teachers who were down in Broward County were completely hamstrung. They were not allowed to suspend Nick Cruz. They were not allowed to expel him, send him to an alternate school, or arrest him. And this was a kid who had made multiple threats on the school, as we know. All of this stemming from a singular narrative that schools are racist and that disciplinary procedures had to be changed. And Tony, when I say changed, I mean talking circles, healing circles, not expulsion, not suspension, not arrest, not juvenile detention, talking circles, as if someone like Nick Cruz could have benefited from a program like that. And we know now that was not the case.
Wow, this is unbelievable. And this is reminding, the first thing that comes to mind when I see this and you see behind the scenes, it's like Planned Parenthood and their sex ed program, which leads to more abortions, which then they cry they need money for abortions and they need more access. SPLC and their liberal policies lead to violence and shooting, which sets up their call for gun control.
Absolutely. And not only that, their calls that teachers are systematically racist, that the schools are racist, give them an opportunity to fundraise. Now, they need to reorient school discipline.
Well, that's the only, I mean, they're like, it's like the string on the back of SPLC. You pull it and it says, you know, racist, bigot. That's the only thing they can come out with. I mean, that's what everything has to be seen through the lenses of racism or bigotry, because that's how they raise their money. But once again, we see the SPLC connected to an outright act of deadly violence. Unbelievable.
Absolutely.
Sarah, you hear the music. You know what that means. We're out of time.
I do. But
I want to thank you for joining us. I know you'll be talking more about this. Folks, out of time, but I do encourage you, go to the website, TonyPerkins.com. Watch this conversation that Andrew had here at FRC earlier in the week. All right, until next time, I leave you with the encouraging words of the Apostle Paul when he says, when you pray, when you prepare, and when you take your stand, by all means, just keep standing.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.